I am glad to be here and to see so many people whose faces I recognize from across the years. And it is always good to come home. And this is home. I said to the bishop that I, when I was a kid, I thought Fort Worth was the largest city on the planet. These buildings seem so small, and now some people have been pulling them down in the ground, lowering them from their height when I was growing up. And when I was growing up, the flying horse in Dallas was about the one thing that you could see from any place in the area. You could almost see it from here in Fort Worth. And now you can't see it because of how the skyline has just exploded. And but it is always good. Most of my family members are here. About 90 Cleavers are in and around Dallas and Fort Worth. I have a cousin who's here, Reverend A.E. Cleaver, who pastors here in Fort Worth, and three other Cleaver pastors in the state. None are Methodists. Some of you may remember Reverend Silas Cleaver of San Angelo, who was United Methodist, and that's been our passion, I guess, and our families going into the ministry. And I never wanted to do it because my great-grandfather, who lived to be 103, and my own children had a chance to play with him, which would have been their great-great-grandfather, Reverend Noah Albert Cleaver, was so poor, and I thought that that was God's way of telling me not to go into the ministry by just being around him. And he, as he aged and no longer preached at the church, he put speakers on the house, on his house, on Wyatt Street in Waxahachie, Texas. People could hear it here in Fort Worth, and people will ask me now, you know, when they'll meet me, they'll say, are you from those preaching Cleavers? And I'm always nervous because I'm expecting somebody to say, well, let me tell you what your grandpa did to me. But I'm glad to be here. I am also very proud to have been from Waxahachie. I think Waxahachie, that experience that I had living 8 years in what used to be a slave shack that still stands today, helped me understand a lot of things that another experience might not have given me. We lived in a shack behind the Templetons, a huge house off Kaufman Street. And both the huge house still stands. It's not as huge as it was when I was a kid, but it is still fairly large. And then those shacks are still there. I've had the opportunity to take my four children there on several occasions so they would see where we came from. And the Waxahachie is the Waxahachie story is a great story, and it looks just like it did when I grew up. It has not changed. It is the same size. And most people, only people in Texas can pronounce it. You get people outside of Texas and they'll destroy it. And only people who live there can spell it. You know, just, and as, you know, people will come up and say, you know, you're from Texas? Yeah, I'm from Texas. I said, well, you know, I was in Mexia. The only people laughing here are people from Texas because they know that's my hair. And so it is, this is a weird state. I was born here, so I can say it. When Lyndon Johnson became president of the United States, I was a little boy trembling, because I listened to all of the black folk coming in and out of our home and at our church talking about what we were in for. I mean, everybody black in this state was scared. Lyndon Johnson was a segregationist. He had hundreds of pieces of rental property, and they were run-down shanties. And then a metamorphosis occurred. Lyndon Johnson, until this very moment, has been the greatest president in civil rights in the history of this nation. And that includes Lincoln. But when Lyndon Johnson began to dismantle segregation, he gave an order that all highway patrols must be desegregated. And he gave them a date. And if they failed, he would immediately withdraw federal funding for highway patrols. And so Texas was obstinate. And on the last day, in fact, they only had until 12 noon on this date to desegregate the highway patrol, the Texas Rangers. And someone went into the captain's office and explained to him that Texas would lose, which in those days was a lot of money, $2 million. And so he said, well, I guess I can't lose that kind of money. He said, we only have 3 hours to get an African-American. So he said, well, let's run over to Houston Tillotson and get somebody. But when he stepped out in the hallway, he saw an African-American mopping. And so he walked over to him and he said, can you drive? The man said, yes. He said, can you shoot a gun? He said, yeah, I would go rabbit shooting quite a bit. And he said, well, raise your right hand. So they swore him in, they put a uniform on him, and told him they'd train him later. They said, look, just get in the car. I want you to just drive, make sure everybody sees you, just drive up and down the highway. And he said, now if you see somebody just going extraordinarily fast, you turn on the lights, your strobe lights, stop them, just give them a ticket, we'll take care of whatever the ticket is. So we was driving back and forth, and a man comes by him going over 100. And this is the moment he's been waiting for. So he turns on the lights, and he gets the man, he pulls him over, and he said, all right, sir. He said, you know, you were speeding. And said you were going about 40 miles over the speed limit. And he said, what's your name? The man said, my name is Bob Richards. Bob Richards, okay. And he said, now, where do you live? 603 Main. Uh-huh. And where is that? He said, Waxahachie. He said, Waxahachie. Tell you what, you get back in your car and you keep driving, I'm going to stop you again in Waco. I was looking, it seems, for the first time at a scripture in 1 Samuel, in the 31st chapter. I'm sure I've read it 1,000 times, and just like almost all of you, particularly the clergy. And in reading it, and this was only 2 weeks ago, I apologize, Dr. McElvaney, I didn't read it when I was in seminary. But reading it, it just triggered my imagination. It's one of the most consequential battles ever fought. And in all my years of reading through this dramatic and world-changing chapter, I had never, ever noticed this text as I did a short time ago. I had carelessly overlooked the end of the reign of King Saul. And of course, that's important because it also meant the ascension of David to the throne. And as you will recall, a great battle was fought between the Philistines and King Saul on Mount Gilboa. It was a fierce battle. The army of Israel was outnumbered, outfought, outmaneuvered. There were hundreds of casualties. And the Bible tells us that many of the troops from Israel fled, leaving David and his three sons fighting for their lives. You know the story. When it became apparent that they would die in battle, David turned to his armor bearer and said, "Use your sword to run me through." And the armor bearer refused. And it was then that Saul took his sword, placed it in the dirt, and fell on it and died. I think that's probably as much as I have read, at least until a couple of weeks ago. But when I looked at it then, I saw something that I'd never seen before. The writer of the text says that on the next day, the Philistines rode down the mountain to strip the dead. People are dead and some are wounded. And the Philistines rode their horses down the mountain to strip the dead. They took jewelry, clothing, sandals, whatever they could find. And reading this scripture reminded me of what is said of editorial writers for newspapers, that they sit on the hill on their white horses, watching the battle, and at the conclusion, they ride down in glory to slay the wounded. This event of long ago reminds me of now. We are still divesting the dead, walloping the wounded, and pillaging the poor. Yes, in 2008, we are still stripping the dead. We only look down the road at New Orleans. Look at what happened when Katrina reached land. And if you take a clear look at what happened in New Orleans, or the Gulf Coast for that matter, you will see that our nation routinely and habitually strips the dead. These are people who are dead to our compassion, dead to our sensitivities. They're dead, and we are strippers. It is estimated that 700,000 people were impacted by Katrina. One-fifth of the population most affected by the storm was impoverished. The three states affected by Katrina were Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. And according to the 2000 U.S. Census, Mississippi was the second highest poverty rate in the United States of America, followed by Louisiana. Alabama was in sixth place. More than 40% of the most impacted population lived below the poverty line. In New Orleans, the House subcommittee, which I serve on, held public hearings shortly after the flood. We discovered that only 23.4% of the people in New Orleans, 23.4% in the Ninth Ward, had a high school diploma. 25% of the residents in the lower Ninth Ward, 25% earned less than $10,000 a year. About 30% of the population did not own a car, and that's why I became outraged when people started suggesting, well, why didn't they leave? My son was down there at Dillard University with a car and still had to spend the night on a Walmart parking lot. These were poor people being blamed for being poor people. Twenty-one thousand people in New Orleans, when the flood hit, did not own a phone. No wonder these dirt poor people were left stranded on rooftops, on front porches, and at the dome. They were economically, educationally, and environmentally dead, and they were stripped of their dignity and their pride. And today, if you go to the Ninth Ward, it is still the way it was when I was there shortly after the flood. If you believe that people in Beverly Hills would still be living in that kind of condition, you are on crack. There is no way that people who are rich would be in those conditions today. Stripping the poor. All you have to do is look at the gas prices. If you want to really understand how to strip the poor and the dead. Gasoline prices are now at a record high, and they're not going to go down. The projection is that gasoline prices will be at $4 a gallon by September. I recently had a conversation with a Teamster who is in business for himself. He owns his own rig, and told me that he pays $1,000 to fill it up. How long can you stay in business filling up with $1,000 a stop? Lee Raymond, the CEO of ExxonMobil, received a retirement package last year of $400 million. And Congress gave ExxonMobil and the other oil companies a $14 billion tax cut. We need to change some oil. There is no shame. They are ripping off the American public. Now, we've got to do some things ourselves, We've got to change our lifestyles. But at the same time, they are going to rip us off. Now, we are in some kind of a battle now for oil with China and India. Their economies are now running at full throttle, which means that there's a great demand for oil. It is an international commodity now. When Rockefeller took control of Standard and raised gasoline to 8 cents a gallon, he controlled 60% of the market, the world market. But that doesn't happen anymore. The Chinese and the Indians are in competition with us for oil. And because they are, the oil companies will use every opportunity to raise the prices. And guess who gets hurt the most? Those who are poor. If you live in a city like Kansas City, Missouri, which is a city of 322 square miles, and all of the jobs are outside the urban core, and you're trying to drive to work every day because there is no mass transportation, you are in trouble. You're going to have a difficult time just going to work. And so when you don't go to work, you are lazy. We're stripping the poor. The minimum wage increased on July 24th of last year to $5.85 an hour. And then in 2009, it will increase to $7.25 an hour. Now, this will impact 12.5 million Americans. And there's not a single person in here, not a single person in here who could live with any degree of comfort for $7.25 an hour. They're barely making ends meet. They live in areas of concentrated poverty that are often characterized by poor housing, high crime, and bad schools. And these folk are getting blamed for their condition. We are still stripping the dead. We beat up on the poor. We call them lazy. We say that they prefer welfare. Well, let me tell you something. I'm personally insulted. I was born in a shack. And when we moved out of the shack, we moved into public housing. Yes, I lived in the projects, federally subsidized public housing. My daddy got up every day, went to work, and then on Saturday mornings, before he went to work, he cleaned up the T.A. Lidekin office building. And then at night, he'd serve parties. My daddy was working three jobs while we lived in public housing. And then when I hear people say, well, you know, they live in public housing, they're buying Cadillacs. Listen, I'm speaking experientially. I lived in public housing. If anybody who lives in public housing can buy a Cadillac, they ought to be the Secretary of the Treasury, not somebody suffering in public housing. My mother started college when I was in the sixth grade. She started Midwestern University. My mother's going to school and working on the side. My daddy is working every kind of job he can get until he finally got us out of public housing. We moved into our own home. And at one point in this society, if you could just move into your own home, it meant that you had become a part of society, that you were a real citizen. Well, not anymore. In the United States, right now, 20,000 Americans are losing their homes a week. 20,000 foreclosures a week. So far, this foreclosure catastrophe has seen the homes fall for 1.2 million Americans. The prediction is that it will go to 3 million. And as the committee I serve on begins to try to address the problem, try to figure out ways to save some of the people who are losing their homes, we hear people saying, well, we don't want to put government money behind people who made stupid decisions. Well, Bear Stearns gets a bailout. The people who lost their homes get counseling. We're stripping the dead. And if you really want to understand stripping the dead, think about the war that is going on in Iraq. During the days of Caesar, an enemy could be chopped up for about 75 cents. Cost about 75 cents for every soldier killed during the time of Caesar. By the time Napoleon attempted to conquer the world, the cost of an enemy corpse had risen to $300. In World War I, the war to end all wars, the cost of killing an enemy was $21,000. A few decades later in World War II, the cost of killing was up to $50,000. Today, it costs the United States approximately $125,000 to kill an Iraqi. The war has cost over $500 billion, which represents $4,681 from each person in this room. We spend $341 million a day to kill and maim. And you know who are not even counted? The Iraqis. We don't even count them. They don't even count. We're stripping the dead. Now, who's fighting this war? As always, poor populations have disproportionately been affected by the war. People with low incomes pay the most in lost lives in Iraq. The proportion of new recruits with a regular high school diploma is the lowest it's been in 25 years. We are now taking what we would call Category 3 recruits. They come from rural and urban areas. These are the people with GEDs. These are the people who don't do well on their test scores. They are the ones we're bringing in to the military. And many of them are joining the military for economic reasons. Today, the recruitment of top soldiers, top recruits, is below 70%. 4,000 U.S. soldiers have been killed. Take a guess at how many of their parents belong to country clubs or to the United States Congress. Zilch. We're stripping the dead. If you're poor enough to go to the military, some went to the National Guard so they could go to college free. Some were in the reserve so they could go to college. And they end up on the sands of Iraq. We're stripping the dead. And if you listen to a lot of my colleagues, we're doing it in the name of Jesus. little girl said to her father after church, "Daddy, the pastor's sermon has confused me." And the father said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And she said, "Well, the pastor said that God is bigger than us. Is that right?" And the father said, "Yes." And so she said, "He also said that God was in us. Is that right?" And the father said, "Yes." And so the little girl said, "Now, I'm confused, because if he is bigger than us and in us, wouldn't God kind of show through?" And that is the dilemma facing the United States, which proclaims itself to be a Christian nation, is that God is not kind of showing through. We have perverted what Christianity means. We go into a war with preemption, as the new doctrine. John Kennedy, 1 year after he was inaugurated, said that the United States would never launch a preemptive attack on another nation. And for some reason, we launch a war against Babylon. Look, there's a room in the Capitol where you can read the classified information. I never go up there for a lot of reasons. But nobody has told me yet that they've seen any intelligence that would suggest we were justified in going into Iraq. And that reminds me of something I saw when I was a little boy here in Texas. We were out in the park, and two flies found some baloney on a knife. And they, after discovering this baloney, they sat there on this knife and just ate and ate and ate, and they took their fill. And after they had eaten all they could eat, they took off, only to just fall flat back to the earth. They'd eaten too much. The moral of that story is you don't fly off the handle when you are full of baloney. Second Cleaver, first chapter, third verse. There is no such thing as a nation being so right that it proves itself right by attacking others so they will say we were right. We are stripping the dead. We are building up more opportunities to strip the dead. This is our nation. This is our country. And I can see what's going on, and it is obscene. My first speech on the floor of the House of Representatives, ...2005... Palm Sunday, I get a phone call in Independence, Missouri, asking that I take a plane to Washington immediately, because we had to take a vote on Palm Sunday night on whether or not we could save Terry Schiavo's life. I got on a U.S. Airways plane, flew to Washington, went to the Capitol. I was angry. Because, friends, what you don't know is that Terry Schiavo was subpoenaed. They were going to roll her body into the chamber of the United States Congress until a judge interfered. And when I spoke, I said to my colleagues, "I agree with you. Congress should become involved in this woman's life. And every member of Congress should sign tonight that should they go into a persistent vegetative state, that Congress will vote on whether or not they should be able to stay on Lifeline. I went on to say that Diane Cleaver, my wife, and my four children are the only people who dare make medical decisions about me. That was a political ploy because this country has grown accustomed to stripping the dead. People said, well, she was alive, her eyes were moving around. Lies. What you saw was 9 hours of footage narrowed down to a few seconds when her eyes moved. Her autopsy showed that her brain had no activity, and most of all, she was blind. Stripping the dead. Stripping the dead in 2005 and in 2008. I've told my family, I want to make sure everybody understands, my family makes the decision. And I've told my wife, I want you to keep me connected to life-saving equipment for 24 hours just to give God a chance to change his mind. But after that, most of you probably don't qualify for the tax surplus, the surplus check that many will begin receiving tomorrow. And anybody who is getting a little $300 check, I'm not demeaning $300. I don't have $300 in my pocket. I would like $300. But let me just tell you, $300 is not going to save you or the U.S. economy. The richest 10% of the people in this country received an awesome tax cut. And in 2009, the tax cut for the 10% of the richest people in this country will equal $139 billion for 1 year. $139,000. $139 billion for 1 year. 1 year. And people want us to jump around with joy for a $300 check. We're stripping the dead. We have a $9 trillion debt. $9 trillion debt. Students at Harvard figured that if you stack $1 bills on top of each other, $1 trillion would go to the moon and back. And we are $9 trillion in debt. Most of the money was borrowed from China, India. We've even borrowed money from the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean. All of the money for Iraq is borrowed. $14 billion a month. All of the money for Katrina was borrowed. And if you count our loan guarantees and the money we're taking out of the Social Security Trust Fund, the U.S. debt is $25 trillion, and your children and your children's children are going to be adversely impacted by that debt because we are stripping the dead. Our question must be different as we move into the middle parts of this 21st century. We cannot ask the question, what must I do to be safe, but what must I do to be saved? And for the United States to be saved, it means we must have some respect for other peoples around the world, and it means that we don't strip our own dead. I ask people, my colleagues, when they get into big arguments about the war, well, now, which kind of bomb do you think Jesus would prefer? What kind of immigration program do you think Jesus would authorize? We're stripping the dead, and those of us who call ourselves Christians understand clearly that we can't separate ourselves, we can't extricate ourselves from our faith and what we believe, and it means that we're going to treat people right because that is the premise of our beliefs. That is what we claim, that is what we hold. We cannot step on people and believe that to be consistent with the gospel. Something has gone terribly wrong in our world. The people of faith must set it straight. The people all around the globe, including this land, are shouting out their desire for salvation. Most people want something done for them. But we must want something done within us. We are looking for someone to change things rather than change us. We want God to save us from terrorists. He wants to save us from sins. And many in the church are placing their hope in military messiahs. They've exchanged their credos for ammo. But those of us who believe that there's a God somewhere must come to the conclusion that we've got to obey him no matter where we are and no matter who opposes him where we are. All of the things that are being talked about, we can set up a new deal, a fair deal, a big deal, a real deal. But if we seek salvation and security from a pistol-packing prophet, we will screw up any deal. Having wasted our substance in a faraway land, we're beginning to experience the stench of the pig pen. With a diminishing image abroad, a recession at home, a $9 trillion war debt, 20,000 foreclosures a week, perhaps we are ready to ponder the possibility that there is a need for us to come to ourselves. We are better than this. I travel all over the world and I have met all kinds of people, and most people are basically interested in just living, just having a life and enjoying their families. Most people in this country are not interested in war. Look at the polls. 75% of the people in the United States are opposed to the war. 75%. Most people are good and decent. They want to be. And we can help lead them. If somebody begins to resist you, somebody doesn't want to change, I can tell you right now how to get them to change. You take them to the gas station. You stand up there as they fill up that car. And when they finish, you say, how was that? Conversions can take place at the gas station because people have come to the realization that something is wrong in our land. The prodigal in the pig pen said to himself, I don't Need this? Why am I in a pig pen? No one has done anything to me. I did it to myself. I manufactured this mess all alone. I essentially molested me. The bad thing, the prodigal said, is that here I am in a pig pen with people around the world hating us. We're having a financial crisis. And I already know that in my father's house, there's enough to spare. We have enough to spare. We can suppress our greed. We can push down our desire to just want more. Society is going to change. We're no longer going to be able to cruise around listening to the radio on Sundays, especially pastors. Times have changed. And people are looking for someone to show the way. If the church cannot show the way, it becomes irrelevant. We don't need a church that is not prophetic. We don't need a church that is not willing to stand up and proclaim, "Thus said the Lord." One of the problems we have right now, we have too many anemic Christians. We want to be little Christianettes. God calls us to stand flat-footed and lead the way. That is our call. That is our responsibility. Is it all over? No. Not for those of us who call ourselves Christians. It's not over. You know, Dan Quayle messed up a few lines when he was the vice president. One time he said in a speech, "You know, a mind is a terrible thing to lose." You laugh, he's right. But I would like to change the Negro, United Negro College Fund theme in my own language. A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. A crisis is a terrible thing to waste. In the middle of a crisis, we need to try to get out of it with something. Don't fight all night in the middle of the stream without getting something out of it. And we can get better. I did a revival in San Francisco 15 years or more, maybe 20 years ago, with Bishop Cornelius Henderson. He wasn't a bishop at the time. He was a pastor at Cascade in Atlanta. And we went to San Francisco to do a revival. He would preach one day at 12 noon, and I'd preach at 7. Then the next day, I'd go at noon, and he'd preach at 7. I took my wife out. I wanted to give her a chance to see the Bay Area. She'd never been there before, and I'd been there. We came in, we were leaving the airport, and I saw a sign that says, "Rent a wreck." And so you could rent a car that had been dented up, and it was relatively cheap. So we rented a car. And so when Bishop Henderson was speaking during the day, I took Diane around the city to show around. And one day I decided to take her to Daly City because my uncle's fiance lived there, and from her home you could see the ocean, and people were hand gliding. It was just a beautiful, almost unearthly view from her living room window. And we started out riding around, and I'm trying to get to Daly City, and she asked me, she said, "Now, do you know the way? You sure you know the way?" Well, of course, the women here don't understand this, but any man who does not say, "Yes, I know the way," should turn in his man papers, because it is almost required that you always know where you're going when your wife asks. And so She's asking me, well, are you sure? And then I'm, yeah, of course I know where I'm going. And so we pass Candlestick Park, and she asked one more time, and then she started the scoot thing where she scoots over to the door on her side. And so I'm riding down the street, the highway, and now cannot even see the San Francisco skyline. And so I'm thinking, oh, man, but I can't let her know that I'm lost. And then God showed it to me. Just in front of me was a sign that said, U-turns permitted. And so I thought, oh, praise be to God. And so I thought, I'll turn around slowly so she won't notice. And so I turned around and headed back. And that night I was sitting in the hotel room thinking about that experience. And I realized that maybe God had given me that experience for a very real reason. And maybe for a time like this, it comes to mind. As terrible as things are in the United States, U-turns are permitted. And for those of us who are people of faith, our job is to turn the nation around because U-turns are permitted.